So I thought that we would just begin with a brief reading out of the New Testament, actually, 1 Corinthians 2, and just because we have a certain hermeneutical advantage here tonight that we need to be aware of. We're in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 10, Paul says, "To us, God revealed these truths through the Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who knows, or who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now, we have received the Spirit, not of the world, but the Spirit that is from God, so that we may know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts and spiritual words. But the natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God. They're foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. But he who is spiritual appraises all things, yet he himself is appraised by no one. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he will instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." And I just think, you know, here this point is that we can understand on a factual level the intended meaning of a text. We can have de dicto knowledge, as we were talking about in the first week. These are statements that can be understood in terms of the grammar, in terms of the history, and so forth. We can put these things together. The natural person can do that. However, there is something in communication here that is richer and more lively and more personal, and that is that we have the Spirit of God that indwells us, and as Paul says in this passage, no one knows the mind of God but the Spirit of God. And so we have this absolutely direct access to the mind of God through the Spirit. And with that direct access, as we get the content of Scripture into our minds, it enables us to have that that ability to think the thoughts of God, to have the perspective of God, to be in a very personal way taught by God. And so in this way, Bible study is just the most awesome thing, because it enables us to connect in a very direct way with God. He wants to communicate to you. And so I think when we are doing our work for a class like this, and maybe sometimes there's effort involved, it's a little bit difficult, it might be challenging at points or whatever, what we have to realize is that we're just learning how to hear effectively. The Spirit of God is trying to train us to hear the voice of God as He speaks to us through His Word. And we will come to that place, and I just encourage you to stay in the discussion and to stay in your work, because there will come with time a true sense of delight, of discovery, of joy in realizing at a moment that I'm really hearing the voice of God as He is speaking to me through His Word. And that's really what this is about. This is not just an academic exercise, some kind of a skill base that we want to learn. This is a way to learn how to communicate with God, listen to His Word to us. And it's just a beautiful opportunity. And I think you will find, as I have, that some of your richest moments in your relationship with God really will come through those times where you are applying yourself in a rigorous way, in a systematic way, to the study of His Word. So I think there's just a huge payoff in what we're talking about in this class, and I want to just put this out there to encourage you to stay at it, to stay working, and, of course, like we were saying, to have fun. All right, why don't we go back to Exodus chapter 3, and where we are going to walk through your assignment. And we're going to also build on your assignment. We've been looking at the Scriptures through a telescope to a large extent, the big picture. We've talked about the nature of biblical narrative, how biblical narrative is the foundation to the entire scripture, really. There is a unity of thought, a unity of intent, that unity is identifiable through that system of promises, blessings, and covenants that God enters into with humanity, and the repetition of those markers, as we have called them, linking passage after passage in these historical narratives together. It's one story. And it's not just one story from the standpoint of narrative. It's one story in the sense that the biblical narrative of the Old Testament is really foundational, as we will see beginning next week, to the message of the prophets, to the teaching of Christ in the Gospels, to the letters of the New Testament, to the closing of the New Testament in the book of Revelation. The whole thing really is rooted in a working out of the broad strokes themes established in these very early narratives. And so we talked about that. We talked about how then to move into a narrative book and begin to examine the structure of a text, the form, the relationship of the ideas that make up the text, how narrators use characters and dialogue and the action, and that in a very conscious way they are introducing techniques that help the reader to understand what the real point of the narrative is. And so we've been exploring that for a while. We're going to do that again in our study of Exodus chapter 3, our review of your assignment. But then really what we're going to focus in on tonight has more to do with the content. We've talked about structure, the skeleton. Tonight we're going to talk about the content, the substance, the ideas that are driving these narratives. So we're just going to follow in a very systematic way in your outline. I've just basically, again, given you my notes so that you don't have to worry about being a stenographer or a secretary or something like that. You just follow along. And I'm just basically going to walk through the structural steps of the inductive study template for narrative. And so we begin with the overview, and which we're saying here that Exodus opens with the Hebrews in bondage under the Pharaoh, who, as it says, knew not Joseph. And Exodus then is a story of God, quote, remembering his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is repeated numerous times, and delivering his people from slavery through Moses, his chosen leader. The section of Scripture is, I think, extraordinary in what it reveals about the person of God and his plan for humanity. And, in thinking this narrative through, I've spent quite a number of months, a couple of years ago, just studying this carefully and thinking it through and doing a series of talks on this. And it occurred to me that in this little window of time, really, from the passage that we're reading tonight where God meets Moses at the burning bush until the end of this narrative sequence at the end of chapter 19, where Moses again is meeting God in the mountain, preparing to receive the law, that this short window of time, and it could not have been more than a matter of months or perhaps at the most a few years, that there's more revelation about the person and intent of God in that window of time than at any other moment in human history except during those years in which the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. So this is really one, and that's why I've chosen this narrative, because it is so densely packed with theological knowledge that I thought this would be a good place for us to really roll up our sleeves and talk through the theology section in your outline. But the point here is that God is introduced to us as the Redeemer, his people are the redeemed, and that Exodus is really the central biblical narrative, retold, reshaped, reworked in every generation of biblical revelation. Every generation goes back to this narrative After Moses, Joshua goes back to this narrative, and it just repeats itself in chapters 1 through 5 of Joshua. The psalmists reflect on it poetically and in the context of cultivating essentially a liturgy for God's people in the Psalms. And the prophets are going back to it. And every generation is connecting what God is doing in their day and the hopes that they have for future in the framework and the context of this extraordinary narrative. It's just an amazing piece of literature. It's an amazing piece of theology. And it's a reflection of a pretty amazing God. All right. So, now I've cheated a little bit in your assignment. And so I gave you chapter 3 to break down, right? And in a real way, chapter 3 is not a complete narrative. Why? Because really it goes on through chapter 4, verse 17. There are no changes in place, people, or time from the beginning of Exodus 3, that is verse 1, through chapter 4, verse 17. Then in verse 18, Moses is released and he goes back to Egypt. So, according to the definition that we have been working with, that's really one large narrative scene, a part of the bigger picture. And so if that was a struggle for you, then too bad. But I chose it again for its theological depth. But at the same time, it does illustrate this fact that you've got a substantial piece of material. And it is, you can break this down in terms of a couple of kind of conceptual things going on here. Where in the first part of chapter 3, really verses 1 to 9, you've got God on the initiative there. And he's making himself known to Moses. And then from verse 10 through the end of the chapter, you have Moses then being commissioned and then interacting and complaining, essentially, with God that he's got the wrong guy. So that's how I've broken this down for you. And in any event, whether it's a part of a narrative or a complete narrative, the same principles of narrative analysis apply. And so I will just walk through them with you, and hopefully that bears in some ways what you have. But if not, then okay. In terms of the setting then, we looked at the context, and the context is the preceding narrative in Exodus 2, which really in verses 11 to 22 is all about Moses. Moses, the guy who, according to Stephen's speech in Acts chapter 7, believed himself before he met God at the burning bush to be the liberator of God's people. And he went out there like revolutionaries do on his own terms and unafraid to use violence and killed a man, was found out, and fled. And chapter 2 ends in real despondency. Moses goes out into the Sinai Peninsula and becomes a part of a Midianite's household, marries the daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son whom he named Gershom, which means a stranger there. And so chapter 2, really, from the standpoint of Moses, ends on a down note. And then after this kind of failure of chapter 2, our writer, Moses, gives a little summary of what is to come in verses 23 to 25. And what kind of a passage is this in verse 23? He says, "Now it came about," this is chapter 2, "in the course of these many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage they had cried out, and their cry for help because of the bondage rose up to God, and so he heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God saw the sons of Israel, and he took notice of them." What kind of a passage is this in the language that we've been using? This is a link, absolutely. This is nothing more than just a restatement of the promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis 12. and then codify it as a covenant in Genesis chapter 15. And so that is strategically placed in the narrative here after the failure of Moses and his retreat into the wilderness. Then this important statement of purpose appears that while it looks bad for the hero of the story, nonetheless, God is at work and God is seeing, God is hearing, God is remembering, and that then sets up the plot and the revelation that comes in the first couple of paragraphs of the story. So that's the context. On the front end, on the back end, is Moses returning to Egypt to let my people go. And then in terms of who's involved in the whole who, where, and when of the story, this first section where God reveals himself, verses 1 to 9, is between Moses and God, or an angel of the Lord, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Where has this happened? This is at Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai. That ought to sound familiar to you. And when? Well, it's after Moses had been in Midian now for some 40 years. That's a long time. It's a long time for a prince in Egypt to be a shepherd out in the irrelevant wilderness of the Sinai Desert. And actually, beyond just what we know from the text right there, there's a broader framework. If you look, for instance, at 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, we get a reference to time where Solomon begins to build the temple in Jerusalem, he says, 480 years after the Exodus. And everyone, and it's a hard date, no one disputes it, Solomon began his reign in the building of the temple in 960 BC. So we can very clearly put a date then to the Exodus from Egypt at 1446 BC. And so I put that out to you because that's the biblical basis for a chronology of these events. And we can, if we were doing a broader study on the Exodus, we would be very interested in then correlating that with Egyptian evidence and evidence from Canaan and other places like that. But I put this forth before you just because I want you to know what the time frame is. Now let's move to plot and dialogue. Let's look at the first nine verses. Just read it together to refresh your memory. It says, "Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness, and he came on Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. And so Moses says, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. And when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground. He said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face and was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, and I am aware of their suffering. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, the Budlite, whatever. Now, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them." Okay, so that's the first scene in the narrative. And it begins with a summons. And, so here we have this picture of Moses. He's just out in the wilderness, and he sees this weird thing, this bush that's burning but is not consumed. And I think we would have to, as we're kind of reading this in a sensitive way, put ourselves in the skin of Moses, who has now lived for 40 years in the desert, whose thoughts of liberating his people had been a distant memory by this time. No doubt, I think probably Moses was a person who had just more or less given up any kind of real vision for his life. He's resigned to his life as a shepherd after all these years. And then to hear these words, verse 4, Moses, Moses, really? And just that in a moment, just the transition that had to take place in Moses' mind from the mundane life that he had come to accept now to this transcendent moment where he learns that God himself is speaking to him and appealing to him from this fire. And I think, again, if you juxtapose where chapter 2 ends with this place of despondency, we could easily imagine ourselves, as a good narrator wants us to see the drama of this incredible moment after 40 years of silence. It is as though now, finally, something's happened. Maybe there's hope. And so the summons is followed by a warning. Don't come any closer. Remove your sandals from your feet. The place on which you're standing is holy ground. Watch your step, Moses. And we'll talk about holy ground a little later. It's an important piece. And then there's revelation. So there's a summons, there's warning, then there's the revelation that God gives in verses 6 to 9. Yes, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. I've heard the pleas of my people, and I have come, he says, verse 8, poignantly, very importantly, so I have come down to deliver them. And which is, in some ways, it's a restatement of verse chapter 2, verses 23 to 25. It's a restatement of the Abrahamic covenant, but with something very importantly different, which is, namely, he's not just hearing and seeing and remembering. What's he doing? What's the verb? I have come. That's a little different, isn't it? It's very different. That's the difference between being an out there abstract observer and a God who is ready to act. And that is the transition that's happening here. And I note at the bottom of this section here that there is no dialogue. There's monologue. Moses and God are not talking in the first scene. Moses is probably cleaning his shorts, and God is speaking. Moses has nothing to say, and that's poignant, that's significant, because Moses, in retelling this story, doesn't want himself in it. He wants to focus on what really matters, which is the revelation of God and the promise of God that he has returned to do what he has promised to do. And so we moved out from the kind of the plot and dialogue stage to the purpose clues in it, and I think very clearly verse 8 is at the center of this narrative. I have come down, he says, to deliver them. And it's set up, I think, so effectively and so artistically, really, from chapter 2, verses 23 to 25, where God hears, where God sees, where God remembers, to this poignant moment here, as I said a minute ago, where God now is prepared to act, deliver his people. And so, because this is very clearly a link to the Abrahamic covenant, because it's very clearly God pronouncing his intent, what he is going to do, these are clues, I think, best heeded by us to say, okay, that is really the center of the story. And I'll defend that thesis at the end. But what I'm going to suggest is that in a common sense reading of this passage, in a careful reading of this passage, what we will be able to find is that by reference to chapter 3, verse 8, all of the material in the narrative fits as an explanation, as an application of this one simple statement, I have come to deliver my people. So the preceding material sets it up by where God reveals himself and establishes his intent. And then the next scene, which is verses 10 to 22, or in reality goes through chapter 4, verse 17, God then commissions Moses, who is to be the agent through whom God will effect his deliverance. And so the setting, again, doesn't change, but I want to pay some attention to the plot and to the development and to the dialogue. I want us to look at some of the purpose clues, then we'll summarize the structure of the text, and then we're going to move from there into a much more detailed study of the theology of the thing. So in terms of the narrative and the dialogue, in verse 10, God commissions Moses. He says, therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. And so, again, what must have been virtually forgotten over the many years of shepherding, this senseless task of following around the stupidest animals that there ever were, a total waste of talent. All of these years go by, and then our author, in recollecting this, uses such a beautiful word, doesn't he? Now. Now. That's so good. Therefore, come now. It's the time. It's like all of that stuff that's gone by has kind of reached this crisis, this pivot moment. And now, everything is different. Now, the promise is a reality. It's time for Israel to be released. When? Now. And Moses then receives his calling, and the dialogue, as we'll see, shows really a new humility in Moses, but not a very mature trust in the Lord. So there is that element to this story that Moses becomes a sort of an ambiguous figure to us in some ways. He's mystifying. On the one hand, he follows, he does what God says, and yet with such incredible reservation. And we will need to unpack that at some point in our lives, because like Moses, all of us are called by God to a task that is impossible for us, a task that's scary. A task that on the one hand God has been preparing us for all our lives, and on the other we're nowhere near man for the task. We're nowhere near adequate to the challenge. So it's pretty interesting. And so it begins then. There are four questions around which the rest of the narrative more or less surrounds. The first is in verses 11 and 12, where in response to this great commission to be the agent of liberation, to let my people go, we have, as we have seen before, the infamous but clause, where you expect the road to go this way, but no, it goes that way instead. You would think that here God's revealed himself, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He's remembered his covenant. Now's the time. He's ready to deliver. Well, of course, let's do this thing, let's go. But no. Moses, it says in verse 11, said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And God said to him, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign
to you that I have also sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship at this mountain. Okay, so Moses is full of self-doubt. Who am I? I'm no one. You know, I thought I was someone at one time, but then I just ran into the wilderness. I've lost 40 years. I don't know. I'm not that important. Lots of doubt. But then God reassures and says that he will give him a sign. So that's the first piece of dialogue. The second piece of dialogue surrounds a second question. This is verses 13 to 15. Then Moses says to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' And they'll ask me, 'Well, what's his name? And what should I tell them?' And God says to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent you.' And God furthermore said to Moses, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. And this is my name forever. This is my memorial name to all generations.'" Okay, so Moses is really basically asking, under whose authority, in whose name am I going back? You know, a man standing under authority, as Moses would be, needs to name that authority in whose name he's coming. And that's really what he's asking. He's saying, tell me the essence of who you are. Tell me your name so that I can go back and I can report to my people. And when God responds, he uses this word, I am. Yahweh, that's where Yahweh comes from. And it's just the Hebrew word, I am. It's the verb to be. And you'll notice in the narrative that there's a fair amount of attention actually paid to these verb tenses. I have come, he says. I will. And I am. In other words, God, the I am, encompasses the totality of time. I was, I will, I am. And that is all Moses needs to know. I am is sending you. And so we're going to need to unpack that because that's interesting. Verses 16 to 22. In the narrative context, again, is an explanation of what Moses is going to encounter when he returns to Egypt. And the rest of the narrative, certainly through chapter 14, reflects exactly what he is describing. And then in chapter 4, verses 1 to 9, Moses raises another objection. What if I fail? To which God says, you got a stick in your hand, right? And he says, well, that stick's going to be good enough because I'm going to work with that stick. And that stick is a staff, and it's going to be, you know, you'd be surprised what you can get out of a stick, if it's my stick. And then he ends with this last piece, you know, I'm so ungifted, I can't speak. To which God says, look, man, this is your fourth objection. You got a brother, right, Aaron. Well, he'll be your mouthpiece, and I'll just go and do this thing. So that's how the whole thing kind of goes. Now, what I want to focus on here, because this is going to set up our discussion of the theology, is the purpose clues in this second scene. In verse 12, God's sign to Moses is an interesting one. He says, what does he say to him? He says, okay, I'm in this burning bush and we're talking. Here's the sign. When you have accomplished what I'm sending you to do, you're going to come back here and worship me in this mountain. And indeed, in Exodus 19, verses 17 and 18, that's exactly what happens. God manifests himself again to Moses on the mountain and in the fire. Same thing. And so from a literary point of view, it's sort of the bookends of the story, where it begins with this theonomy, this visitation of God in the fire. And it ends with exactly the same thing. And so there's a symmetry to the literary piece to it in that way. In verse 15, this is important. For the third time, starting in verse 15. For the third time, chapter 2, verse 23 through 25, chapter 3, verse 6, for the third time, we're reminded that the Lord is the God of promise. How many times in the narrative does God say, I will? A lot. I forgot to add it up, so that's my bad, but there's a bunch. And remember, we talked a couple weeks ago about this, the Hebrew technique of repetition. And what's repeated is important, and it really gets at the point that our author is trying to make. And so in just this very short three paragraphs, really, three times, he's gone back to the promise of God to Abraham, to the Abrahamic covenant. So again, that just is absolutely central to the theological and literary purpose of this piece. Then in verse 15, when God identifies himself as Yahweh, he says that this is my memorial name. A lot has been made of this passage and a similar one in chapter 6. And we're going to have to investigate this a little bit more when we get into our theology section. But clearly what's being rolled out at this stage of the narrative is that this amazing event, the exodus of God's people from their bondage to Egyptian slavery into freedom, is in a sense God's signature act. It's his memorial. That's why it's his memorial name. What could summarize what God is about more succinctly and more powerfully than the liberation, the redemption of his people from slavery and leading them to their land of promise? And that's essentially what's being said here, is that this captures the essence of what God is about. I am is the God who does this in history for you. And so that's why when the Passover takes place, and as the last plague and the people are finally allowed to go, a great deal of ink is spilled in chapter 12 describing how the Passover is to work, and that it is a permanent memorial to God's for God's people, and it is the beginning of the year for them. So all of the attention, the significance of this event is just repeated all over the place, and we need to understand that God revealing this personal pronoun, this his own name, is in the context of this extraordinary act. And then, by way again of purpose clues in verses 16 to 22, the summary is given. And it ends with Egypt, the promise that Egypt will be plundered, as indeed occurs and recorded in chapter 12, verse 36. And it just demonstrates, again, the sovereignty of God over the affairs of history. So, really, two significant scenes in this narrative, all made sense or reconciled out of this one main point in verse 8. I've come down to deliver my people from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them to a good and spacious land. And if we could just summarize then the first scene, the first nine verses, the reader is connected with the God who promises, the God of history. The God of history who is both sovereign, who will accomplish his purpose, and who is holy. Okay? And then in the second scene, God sends Moses. But again, it's God who is the central figure, and the verbs really bear this out. God, he says, will be with you, verse 12. Verse 17, God will bring you up. Verse 19, God knows what the Pharaoh will do. And because of that, the Lord's hand will strike Egypt with the miracles that he says, I shall do in their presence, and I will grant favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. Everything that happens, everything that leads to the Hebrews' release from captivity, is something that this passage says that God is doing. God is doing it. He's using Moses, but God is the agent. God is the driver. God is making these things happen. And so, with that in view, we see our main point, verse 8, clearly stated, what God is going to do in delivering his people. And it is supported by who is God. He is the holy God of covenant promise, and he is called a human agent through whom God himself will affect every step of their liberation. And so, the first week of class, we talked about, you know, the cool thing about inductive Bible study is you can check your work by the canons of inductive logic, inductive reasoning. Remember that? So, the central criteria for inductive proof is adequacy, namely that your understanding of what the main point is adequately explains all of the details in the text, that by reference to what you think is the main point, everything else makes sense. It all falls into place either by illustrating that point or applying that point or clarifying that point in some way. And so I think that we've been able to show that that's been done in this case. If we identify chapter 3, verse 8 as the main point, really every dimension of the narrative just makes sense in light of that. But when I'm done charting out my scenes and I step back and I say, okay, so what is the either explicitly stated or clearly implied point that the narrator is making in reference to which everything in the narrative more or less makes sense, falls into place, supports it, exactly. So like I've done in your outline on page 33, I just, or whatever page it is for you, it's my page 33, I just describe that. I say, here's the main point, and here is how the two scenes that make up this narrative support it. If you approach a narrative text like we're doing here, what you will find, and I think often in dialogue, sitting around a table with somebody that you're meeting with for Bible study or something like that, you know, just to walk through these steps and talk about, you know, what is the main point here? What do you think is the main point here? Well, I think it's this. Really? Well, I think it's this. How do we know? Well, is your analysis adequate? Does it meaningfully explain each of the elements of the scenes in the story? And so I think just that's why this is an art as much as it is a science. There are objective techniques that we need to use. There are steps involved. But understanding kind of being able to see the text through those steps is a bit of an art. Like I was describing, maybe it was last week. You know, if you are learning to play the clarinet, you're going to hit some sour notes. And but if you stay at it and you continue to get used to that reed in your mouth and the fingering and all that kind of stuff, you will come to a point where the words on the page, the notation on the page, just kind of naturally creates movement in your fingers and in your mouth. You know what I'm saying? And you go from sour to sweet. And that's just what it's like to learn how to do literary interpretation of any kind, but certainly biblical interpretation. It's just simply, it's a matter of reps and of getting in there and trying to identify what's the main point, how is it supported, defending your thesis to your friend who's in doubt. And it's just, you know, you just will find that you begin to see things and things clarify for you, and you come to that place eventually where it's like, you know, I think I got it on this passage. And that's sweet. That's a lot of fun. All right? So, there you go. Now, I want to move ahead. We're not done talking about structure. We've got, you know, we're going to be back at this when we talk about the prophets, when we get to the Gospels, because so much of the Gospels is narrative that it's going to be like that. So that's the structural analysis. I think this is an important part of interpretation. Frankly, in my opinion, doing close structural study is the one thing that is usually left out of systematic Bible study. Most of the time when people do studies of the Bible, they're going directly to what does this say theologically, what are the theological assertions here, and how do I feel about it? How's it talking to me? And those are both perfectly good questions, of course, but they're not the primary question, which is how are the ideas in the text related to one another? What is the logic of the passage? How has our author chosen to arrange this material so that a coherent piece of communication is actually taking place? You see what I'm saying? And that's why I've belabored this, and we're going to continue doing that in each of these genres, because it's hard to find resources, Bible study resources, that get you into these kind of structural studies, and yet they're so important in terms of really capturing the intent of the author. Now let's move to the issue of content. We've talked about form, now let's talk about substance. Let's talk about these ideas that drive the text, the historical and cultural framework of our text. And again, this comes right off of your template, and I'm just going to explain it and give several examples of it, and then we're going to go to the passage that we've just examined. We'll note here that all literature, and certainly the Bible and biblical narratives, were written to a particular audience within a particular historical and cultural context. Okay? We're not written in a hermetically sealed bubble. They're not written from an acultural perspective. They're written in culture, in history, with all manner of things going on around them. An inductive method really is a way to search and identify and understand these cultural dimensions, these historical dimensions, because they will relate to the intended meaning of the text. The way we use language is not just a, you know, a non-historical statement of meaning in some objective sense. The language that we choose operates, doesn't it, out of a particular historical context. The jargon that we use, the metaphors that we use, the ideas that we convey, these are things that we are getting from the culture around us, and we are reshaping those things and putting them out as our own. But everybody operates from a cultural perspective. And so good Bible study involves understanding what that historical, cultural, linguistic background and context is. And in your outline, I've just suggested 5 books that you have to go out and buy by next week. No, I don't mean that. But if you were smart, you would. Because these are the things that you can be into Bible study 30 and 40 years, and you find yourself regularly going back to. Everyone needs to get a Bible dictionary. There's a cheap one-volume Bible dictionary by J.D. Douglas called the New Bible Dictionary. It's not so new anymore. It's about 40 years old. But the history hasn't changed that much, and so it's really useful. W.E. Vine Expository Dictionary of the Old and of Old and New Testament Words. That is gold. That takes every major word in the Bible and gives its Hebrew and Greek words. It's translated in these English words. And it describes the range of the meaning of these words. So if I was to say to you, have a good day, some of you might think, what a nice guy he is, wishing me to have a good day. Others of you are going to say, the jerk, have a good day. Well, which is it? It's the same word, right? Oh, but it means something very different. And so what we need to understand is that the same word in English may have many words in the original biblical languages that are translated that word, but mean very different things, very nuanced things. And so having a Bible dictionary is an awesome tool. It's a great way to get at the sense of the meaning of words that are especially important to the meaning of a text. We'll look at some examples of that in a little bit. An expository dictionary. I mentioned last week Leon Wood's A Survey of Israel's History. It's the easiest read. It's the most informative read I know of in terms of just describing Old Testament history. It's awesome. And I used to have piles of them and gave them away, but I have none left. I had a professor many years ago named S. Lewis Johnson, and S. Lewis Johnson said, if I were to be unfortunate enough, or perhaps fortunate enough, to be stranded on a desert island, and I could have one book in addition to my Bible, what would that book be? He said, and I agree, a concordance. Absolutely, a concordance. A concordance is an accounting of every single word in the Bible. And it's sorted by word. And why does that matter? Well, because when you read, especially in narratives, but we'll see this also in the New Testament, in the epistles, a word, and you're like, well, that seems like an important word. That seems like a word that I've maybe read before. Like what? What might come to mind as an important word? Grace. Joy. Promise. Redemption. Any manner of words. You say, well, that just seems like an important word. So you go to your concordance and you're like, oh my gosh, there's 400 citations of this word in the Bible, and this is where they all are. And you begin to realize, well, here's a particular author who loves to use that word. It's a very important word. I'll bet that's going to be central to the theme that drives this person's book. Or it will give you a broad range of how that word is used across the scripture, things like that. And a concordance, you just absolutely have to have a concordance if you're going to do good Bible study at this level that we're describing here. Also, I suggest commentaries. And commentaries are really a mixed bag. And there are some really good commentaries, and quite frankly, there are some really poor commentaries. And as far as Old Testament is concerned, I think the best entry into significant Bible study is the Tyndale Old Testament series, edited by Wiseman. And some of those commentaries, again, they're not new. They were written in the 60s and 70s. But here we are in the 2000, whatever we are. And I go back and I read these things still because they're awesome. And some of the best communicators and the best scholars in the world have come together to write these things in a very simple and approachable way. I think having a good set of commentaries is very helpful because, you know, you do your inductive work and you say, did I get it? Well, why don't I read a commentary and see if that can shed some light on this thing? And I think that that's a great idea. So that you can run a fair amount of money up in buying these things, which I still think would be a good idea. We used to in school decide and see, am I going to have lunch or buy a book? Well, that's not even a question. Of course I'm going to buy the book. Hunger for knowledge is better than, whatever. Now we're in the internet age, and there are websites like BibleGateway.com and Bibloss.com where you can get all manner of Bible study resources free. So there you go. No excuse. You got your own commentary, atlases, dictionaries. You got it all on those two websites. Or if you're really cool, you'll go out and buy hard copy. All right? So just to have these tools to enable you to do work on this more microscopic level where we're examining phrases, we're examining particular words, we're trying to understand them from their historical and cultural background, but also we'll see as well theologically we're going to examine them from that perspective as well. But in the inductive study worksheet that you have under the cultural historical content, we ask that you identify and describe customs, objects, events, and people in the narrative that seem relevant to the story. And so, again, because we're writing, you know, in the case of Moses, he's writing in the 15th century B.C., that's a culture that's really pretty different than ours. You know, not too many of us are riding camels and, you know, building pyramids and things like that. It's a different world entirely. And the more we know about that world, the more able we are going to be to enter into the mind of the author. And so key words that are used need to be explored. So, for instance, in Exodus chapter 6, verse 6, where God says that I have come to redeem my people. What does it mean, redeem my people? That seems like a very religious word. But no, it's not. It is a word very rich in the culture of the ancient Near East in the second millennium B.C. To redeem means to buy out of slavery. And the person who, if you have a member of your family who's been taken captive in war or who have sold themselves into slavery because of their poverty, it was more or less viewed to be, you know, close to an obligation, really, of the elder of a family clan to purchase the release of the enslaved person. And that act of purchasing their release is called, yes, you got it, redemption. And the redeemer is a goel. It's a Semitic word. And so in the ancient world, you know, as Moses is being communicated to by God, and God is telling Moses, who's also locked into history and culture and space and time, when he's explaining to him who he is and what he has come to do, he says, well, I've come to redeem my people. And that would be something that Moses would totally identify with. And the richness of that, to see that God views himself as the as a father, as a patriarchal head who's sees it as his responsibility to look after and care for and liberate, that is, redeem his enslaved clanspeople, his family. You know, that made total sense to Abraham, and that's to Moses. And so we would get that information by looking at a Bible dictionary. We see this word redeem. What does that mean? And so we find out what it means. And we find that that's a very rich history. And you go from listening to the Bible on a staticky radio to seeing it in full high-def TV by understanding how these words are used and what they mean and so forth. The idea of cutting a covenant, for instance, would be the same sort of way. In Genesis 15, the covenant ceremony that God enters into with Abraham has a rich cultural background to it. Or in the narrative that we're discussing here, in the plagues narrative, you know, each of these plagues that God effects through Moses, in Egypt, he says something interesting about that. He says, this is in Exodus 12, verse 12. It's not the only place it's mentioned, but I think it's the first place it's mentioned. He says, "For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike down the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. Against all the gods of Egypt I will execute my judgments. I am the Lord." The same thing is mentioned in Numbers 33 and verse 4, where the plagues are identified as defeats of the gods of the Egyptians. Well, that's kind of odd, unless you understand that Egyptians, like other ancient peoples, were polytheists. That is, they deified various objects and forces in nature. They viewed them to be gods, and they would then placate those gods by ritual, by sacrifice, by various kinds of things. And what this text is telling us is that when God sends these plagues on Egypt, they're not random, they're not arbitrary. That they are carefully chosen as not only catastrophic events on Egypt's economy that would bring Pharaoh to his knees, but which would also give rise to great fear among all the Egyptians that the God of the Hebrews is greater than all of their gods. See? And so in your handout, you see, and this is basically taken from an article by the British historian Kenneth Kitchen in, you got it, the New Bible Dictionary, the thing I told you to go out and buy, his little article on the plagues. He makes the point that in almost every case, you can identify a particular plague with a particular deity known to be worshipped in Egypt during this time. And it really kind of makes an intriguing case for the thought that when it says in Exodus 12, verse 12, that these plagues are defeats of the gods of the Egyptians, that that's exactly the intent. That's the whole purpose. It's not just some amazing thing that God does, but these are carefully constructed narratives to show that God has been very strategic in his approach to destroying the back of the resistance by Pharaoh. Does that make sense to you? Okay. In every inductive study you do, especially in historical narrative, you're going to want to look for key words, words that really kind of where the meaning of the passage is more or less rooted. And you're going to say to yourself, I wonder what that word means. And so you're going to go to a Vine's Expository Dictionary, you're going to go to a New Bible Dictionary or whatever, and you're going to look that up, and you're going to say, huh, well, that's really interesting. I could see, because this is what this word means in its historic context, that what I see going on in this passage is a lot richer than I would have otherwise been able to notice. And so there's a sweetness to that. And frankly, it makes the text make a little bit more sense as well. You wonder what's going on here. Why is this happening? And then you read and you realize, well, here this passage is connecting with a part of ancient history that I just didn't know anything about. But now I do, and so I got it. So I'm cool about that. Okay? Now, I want to talk a little bit about theology here, and really which is going to occupy most of our discussion here tonight. This is really the crucial part of our inductive analysis. The history is important, but it's only important in as much as it brings us to an understanding of the theological importance of the ideas contained in it. And so I'm basically, in your outline, I've just given each of the questions that we ask in the worksheet under theology, and I'm giving specific example explanations of them, and then I'm going to give specific examples from the narrative of Exodus 3 that you studied already. Okay? So I'm going to get started, then we'll take a break here in just a little bit before we get into it, into the Exodus study. Theology, Old Testament narratives are written from a theological perspective and are meant to advance the ongoing revelation of God in history. That's just, we've said this over and over and over again. These are theological works. They're not merely literary works. And so there are a handful of steps that we want to begin to ask of the text. And the text is not necessarily going to give us information about each of these things, but it will give us information about some of these things. And so the first thing we want to ask is to identify and define key theological terms or concepts. And very importantly, in our study of Old Testament narrative, would be things like the names for God, and which is actually pretty important, and how they are used, and especially that's important in the Exodus 3 text, which we'll turn to here in just a few minutes, in a little bit. But each of the names for God, while translated God, or, you know, God Almighty, or what it, Lord, in the English, have a much richer meaning in the Hebrew. And so some examples would be the root word in Hebrew for God is El. And when God is referred to, sometimes it's just, you know, a God. You know, there's the God of Canaanites, you know, El. But God, the God, the God of the Hebrews, Elohim. So in English, at least in the New American Standard Bible, when the word God is used in the Old Testament, it's almost always Elohim, which is the I-M ending. That's a plural. And so that's raised questions about, you know, did the Hebrews believe in many gods or something like that? And I think the best way to answer this question is to recognize how in Hebrew plurality is used. And there is a concept called the plurality of amplification. In other words, by putting a plural ending on something or someone, we are showing the importance of that person or the importance of that thing. And so God is not just El, he is Elohim. He's like the real God, the real thing, the big kahuna in the sky. And so an example of that would be, you know, of something not relating to God would be like in the very important anonymous servant passage in Isaiah 53. You're familiar with that. In verse 9, it refers to the death of the servant, right? Well, that death is in the plural. It's deaths. Deaths. And it doesn't mean that the servant died many, many times or anything like that. It's used to amplify the importance of what he did. And so that's how plurality is often used, and it's certainly used in that context as a reference to God. El Shaddai, God Almighty. El Elyon, the God Most High. Yahweh, which we'll talk about again in just a little bit here, is the proper name for God. It's like, you know, my name is Jim. Well, his name is Yahweh. It works like that. Or Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God. Or Adonai, the Lord. And there are variations of other ones as well. These are the key ones. And then there are also descriptive terms of God. Things that connect who God is with important narratives in the Old Testament. So God is referred to as the rock. God is the king. God is judge. God is shepherd. God is father. God is the living God. God is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. And which again is a Hebrew way of communicating. You state opposites in an attempt to draw attention to the totality. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He is The whole deal. That's who God is what that's trying to say. And so we want to, as we do these studies, we want to say, how is the word God being used here, and how might that help us understand in a deeper way the meaning of this passage? What does the text tell us about God? That's what we want to know. Whether it's just the term itself or a description that we have of God, we want to write this down. We want to say, here's what it says about God. God so often is the subject, of course, of these narratives. Then, secondly, we want to describe what the narrative teaches about the plan of salvation. Again, all of these narratives are part of the redemptive plan of God in history, right? And as such, therefore, we want to ask ourselves, how does the particular narrative that I'm studying fit into this broader plan of God? So any reference or allusion to a blessing or a promise or a covenant, we'd want to identify that, just like we did already in our study of Exodus 3. We saw three examples of the Abrahamic promise linked into that passage. And it tells us then, as readers, that this story that we're reading, the calling of Moses, the declaration that God will deliver his people, is directly connected to and is the fulfillment, in fact, of a key provision of God's promise to Abraham. We'll note as well, in terms of the plan of salvation, contrasts emerging sometimes between God and the religious practices and even the deities of Israel's neighbors. And when these come up, they should be noted. Those are important contrasts that show a very different way of viewing the world, a different worldview, a different concept of God, and certainly a very different perspective on what does it mean to stand in right relation to God. And so sometimes it's very evident in the text, like in 1 Kings 18, Elijah's battle with the prophets of Baal. Sometimes it's, you know, a little bit less direct, like, for example, in Exodus 7 to 12 in the study of the plagues, you know. That's a battle in the heavens. And so, but that bears some study for us to get to that place. But once we do, there's important insight there, because what is it saying? It's saying that God is greater than all of the so-called gods of the greatest kingdom on earth in his day. That's significant. We ask, is the narrative an example of a pattern of salvation, which we have seen so many times? For instance, is it a story of redemption or forgiveness or reconciliation? What terms are used to describe the plan of God? And so in our passage that we've been looking at, Exodus 3, what would be a key word that describes the plan of God in that narrative? Deliver, of course, that's central to the main point. To deliver, or its synonym, to redeem, is key. And so we would really want to understand how words are being used that describe the work of God. And so we just summarize it here in this bold statement. Says, what does the text say about the plan or nature of salvation? And those three little sentences that preceded are just ways of getting at that question. Thirdly, we want to describe what the narrative teaches about the human condition. You know, I think one of the things that is so interesting about reading the narratives of the Old Testament is that they don't in any way attempt to make heroes out of people who are not. They describe people warts and all. And, you know, Moses was a great man, but Moses was all kind of screwed up. You know, David was a great man, but he was a murderer and an adulterer. And the biblical narratives are extremely important in terms of describing what's wrong with humanity. What does it mean? How does sin manifest itself? We saw this last week in the story of Jonah. How did sin manifest itself with Jonah?
Well, how about expressions used like fleeing from the presence of the Lord? How about the sniveling Jonah of chapter 4, who's all distraught over the death of this gourd that was caused to grow up overnight and had no compassion like God does for the 120,000 persons living in Nineveh who don't know the difference between their right hand and their left. See? So we want to make observations about what does the text say and how does it describe or illustrate the human predicament, human sin, what's wrong with people. And when we come to application, we're going to see that that's going to be a really kind of an important part of this thing, is we want to see ourselves in the main characters that drive the story. And lastly, we want to consider how the narrative reflects or advances key theological themes in the Old Testament. And so, whereas the first or the second question asks, what does the narrative teach about the plan of salvation? That's an important thing. What we're asking in 4 is, how does it link with other passages? So, for instance, are there clear allusions or references to other biblical texts in the text? And very importantly, how does this relate to subsequent revelation? Let me give an example of what I'm talking about here. So, if you're in Exodus chapter 17, and they've been released from their bondage to Egypt, the Red Sea has parted, the Israelites have gone into the desert, the waters have closed and drowned the Egyptian army. Now where are they? Well, they're out in a desert. They're in a desert, and deserts are not places where water is readily accessible to populations in the hundreds of thousands, or probably millions. And so, one of the things that God does to provide for his people is that he produces water from this rock. Remember the story? And indeed, that rock, it just seems to roll along with them. And it's interesting that at the end of Moses' life in Deuteronomy 32, as Moses is looking back over his life and he's talking about the legacy of God's faithfulness, he says, God is our rock. And in narrative context, of course, what does that mean? It means that God has been providing in this terrible desert, God has provided. That's what he means when he says God is the rock. And then in Psalm 78, similarly, the psalmist reflects on the provision of God and his goodness to Israel and throughout Israel's history up to this point. And he says, God is our rock and our salvation. See what I'm saying? See where this is going? Now, interestingly, when you come to the New Testament and you read passages, for instance, like 1 Corinthians 10, verse 3 to 5, and we see Paul referring back to the Exodus, and he says, among other things, that the rock was Christ. What does he mean by that? Well, interesting, if you understand the history of how this rock is used in the Old Testament, it makes perfect sense what Paul is saying. He's saying that God has continued to provide for his people throughout time, and that the ultimate provision of God's for human need is, in fact, Christ. Not just an angel of the Lord, but God incarnate himself. It just follows perfectly from how the concept of rock is used throughout the Scripture. And so what I'm asking is, as we are reading Old Testament narratives, we want to be sensitive to, are there things being referred to that are referred to over and over and over again outside of this passage
that form a certain kind of like a motif, a kind of a sign of meaning. And we've talked about that in terms of the barren woman theme and the whole Exodus concept itself, which is repeated so many times, both in the New and in the Old Testament. And so we want to be aware of these things as we study narrative. Is the some of the key elements of the story being repeated in other contexts, and so it kind of creates this picture or this paradigm of salvation, what God is up to. So if we are interacting with the meaning of the key concepts or words from these four perspectives, then I think that we are really going to be at that place where we are grasping in a rich way, and in an edifying way, what the meaning of this text is.